Welcome everyone to a new episode of the Quantum Gravity Seminar. And so today we have Florian Girelli, who's gonna tell us about 3D gravity and quantum groups. But before we get started, I just want to tell you how you can ask questions during the seminar. So in order to avoid too many people interrupting, if you want to ask a question, there is a button you can push that says raise your hand, and then I will unmute you so you can ask your question. So if you want, if you have the urge of asking a question in the seminar, just push the button and I will unmute you. You can ask the question. Then at the end of the seminar, everyone can then ask question without raising their hands. But remember that we first give priority to students and postdocs. Okay, so with these rules cleared out, I let Florian start.
All right. Thank you, Daniele, and hello, everyone. So today I would like to talk about some work that I've been doing with Maite, Laurent, and some students, Abdelmajid and Julian. And this is basically trying to answer a question I had since my PhD, I believe, so a long time ago now. Which is really why we do get a quantum group in the context of 3D gravity. And I believe that I think I have somehow a good answer now. All right, so let's get started. So that's basically the 3D gravity action with a cosmological constant. And so if you rewrite this action in terms of the Chern-Simon formulation, for example, you can use a Fock-Rosley formalism and a combinatorial quantization, or you can use the path integral quantization. And then at the end, what you get is that you get a quantum group structure. So in our theory here at the beginning is defined in terms of Lorentz. You got the gauge theories, the Lorentz, or the rotations, depending on the signature. And here at the quantum level, we get the gauge theory is actually deformed. And the deformation is parametrized by a parameter. And this parameter is actually really related to the cosmological constant. So somehow we go from a theory where there is just a plain gauge theory, so it's just plain gauge theories, to a theory where we have a deformation of these gauge symmetries, and they are deformed in terms of the cosmological constant. The point is that usually when you do that, this structure appears more like of regularization, like in Fock-Rosley formalism. It's a regularization of the Poisson structure for the holonomies, and so on. So in fact, there is another way to get the quantum group structure. It's through the Thurey-Virot model, which was also introduced as a kind of a regularization for the Ponzano-Rigier model. And then there is obviously the important work by Carrier, Malerandro, and Daniele, who try to derive also this quantum group structure from a more canonical picture, a QG picture. And I believe that at the end, at the very end, Daniele's work, he had to regularize, if I recall correctly, the Hamiltonian constraint, and that was a regularization as well, though we might discuss about that. So today what I would like to do is basically try to find a new way. And so a new way means that I would like to avoid these different approaches. And so I would really bear in mind the fact that so the 3D gravity that we have, the 3D model that we have at the beginning, is defined in terms of plane gauge transformation, and at the end they are deformed, right? So I want to try to address this issue. So I want to avoid all these concepts, right? So Chern-Simon, I want to avoid Thurey-Virot, I want to try to avoid talking about some regularization. And I want to get to the treasure island. That's kind of getting a quantum group structure. So here is all the things I want to avoid. So let's find a map. Here's my map. That's going to be the map I'm going to explore. And if you go for a journey, it's important that you prepare well, right? So we're going to need a guiding principle, compass, and a good chip, okay? And usually, of course, if you have well-equipped, well-prepared, the journey goes very smoothly. And obviously, we know the endpoint, right? We know that we can get a quantum group at the end. So here, really, the emphasis is going to be on the journey, right? It's not we're going to get quantum groups. We know since many years that we have quantum groups. And so the question is, how are we going to get there? So let's have the plan. So the plan is to prepare. And so we need to compile the guiding principle. It's going to be basically talking about boundaries. So this is a project with Laurent, and you can, of course, I have to talk about boundaries. And in fact, I really believe indeed that this boundary approach is going to help to frame the question in a very nice big picture. The second thing that we're going to have is what's going to carry us is going to be we're going to divide to truncate, and I will explain how. So we could say that's kind of a discretization, but I think discretization is kind of a poor word for that. I think we really have a good recipe here to get to the discretized variable. Once we have that, then we're going to basically go through the journey, and obviously we're going to make it. And so then once we make it, so what? So obviously we would hope that this is going to be useful for doing the 40 cases well. All right, so let's embark for the trip. So let's set up the context first. So 3D gravity with a cosmological constant in the usual formulation, right? So we have gravity. So here I'm using just quantities with a single variable. So sigma is going to be the signature. We can here it's Lorentzian or Euclidean. We'll often use this cross thing for encoding the epsilon. Then we can look at the equation of motion. That's the standard thing. Oops, I forgot the sigma over there. But that's basically the curvature of the connection is related to the cosmological constant. And here, that's the torsion. Torsion is zero. We have a symmetry for this action. We have the gauge transformation. So that's the standard gauge transformation. So with the epsilon here, and here that's a standard gauge transformation for gauge connection. And we'll note that, like I was saying initially, the gauge transformations do not depend on the cosmological constant. We have also the translation symmetry, and the translation symmetry do depend on the cosmological constant over there. So we have symmetries. These symmetries are generated by charges, so they're like the generator of a symmetry transformation. I can look at the algebra of these charges. And when you look at the algebra of these charges, we see that there is a central extension. That's something that pops up, obviously, also when you deal with the Chern-Simons formulation. And so if we demand that the coefficient here, that the derivative of these coefficients are zero, so that's on the boundary, I don't have any central extension. And then we recover just the charges from some algebra. So depending on the signature and sign of the cosmological constant, we get SO2-2, SO3-1, twice actually, or SO4. SO4 being the Euclidean case with positive cosmological constant. The key point is that, one of the key points also is that the frame field here, if we can choose to represent, to encode this frame field in terms of the boost, okay? And so here, I believe that what makes the theory difficult to discretize or quantize as such is that there is no dependence on the cosmological constant at the level of the gauge transformation, right? And so and at the quantum level we have such a dependence, so somehow something has to happen there. And also the fact that the frame field is with value in a boost. That makes it difficult to discretize, right? Because boosts are not do not form a Lie algebra, and so we don't really have polynomials and so on. All right, so that's current, that's what is done usually. So that's the current setup. And now, what I would like to do is to do something a bit different. What I'm going to do is that I'm going to add a boundary term. This boundary term is going to be parameterized by a vector n. I'm going to demand that this vector n is not changing under the variation, okay? So if I add a boundary term like that, boundary term is not going to really change the equation of motion, but it's going to change the symplectic potential. Symplectic potential is going to be changed. So that's what I'm doing. Actually, here is going to be a canonical transformation. because I ask that the variation of this n is zero, this means that I can actually redefine my connection in terms of the frame field. So I'm doing actually a canonical transformation. I get a new connection, and this new connection is basically a function of the old connection. And now you see there is a dependence on the frame field. I think that's also something that Daniele, Alejandro, and Karim had back in the days, but not this exact transformation. So this is a canonical transformation, and I think that you see I can add this performing this canonical transformation by adding a boundary term, and that's kind of the same idea as what is done in 4D when you add the Hoeffs term or you basically do the canonical map. And I think seeing the thing from a boundary perspective is kind of putting is kind of connecting what with what Laurent was talking the other day. And I will comment further about that at the very end. Okay, so I get a new connection. Okay, this new connection depends on the frame field as well. So what I want to do is that I want to re-express my action in terms of the new connection. So it's just a bit of algebra. Wolfgang, here's a question. Daniele? No? Okay, I'm going to continue. I don't hear anything. Yeah?
No, we can go Wolfgang.
Wolfgang?
Wolfgang?
What? You should be unmuted if you want to ask a question. No.
Okay.
Wait.
What's going on? Chat 2.
Ah, okay. His microphone is dead, he says. Okay, let's go on. Let's see if he can fix it. He can raise the hand again later.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm doing a bit of algebra. I think... okay. So I'm doing a bit of algebra. And I see that, I get an extra term here. And this extra term is just actually proportional to the volume term and n square. And in fact, so if we pick n square to be equal to minus the cosmological constant, then essentially this term is going to cancel the term that we have here in the action. So this means that we're going to cancel the volume term, and the action that we had initially is going to be, can be just written in this simple manner. So that's going to be our new action. So if we put this constraint, of course we have a metric, and so we have to see what are the constraints on the vector n that we must have. So that it's consistent. So for example, if lambda is negative or positive, sorry, lambda positive, and then we are in the Euclidean case. In the Euclidean case, this number is going to be positive. If lambda is positive, this is a negative number. So we see that n has actually to be pure imaginary. And you're starting to see why somehow the case Euclidean and lambda positive is actually peculiar with respect to the others. If lambda is negative, that's going to be fine, it's space-like. We have also, so if lambda is positive, that's going to be time-like in the Lorentzian case and so on.
Wolfgang has typed the question and is asking if Ni is the normal to the boundary.
I'm not talking about, no. The short answer is no. Just a parameter, it's just a vector. I'm just taking it as a vector. We could try to see if we could put extra assumptions on that, but currently I'm not demanding it's the normal to the boundary. Okay, so we have different. N has different. The nature of n depends on the sign of the cosmological constant and obviously the signature of the metric. And we notice that the Euclidean case positive cosmological constant is special here. It's imaginary. So let's look at the equation of motion. So if we look at the equation of motion of this action, so we get, again, some curvature equation here, and then we get the torsion equation. And you see that here, that's kind of the torsion, but now it's the torsion with respect to the new connection. And now we do have an N here. So this means that actually this torsion equation does depend on lambda, okay? And you remember that usually that's a torsion, the torsion constraint that generates the gauge symmetry. So this is actually good looking if you want to get a lambda appearing in the gauge transformations. In fact, if you look at the symmetries, indeed, you have the gauge transformation. And the gauge transformation, so here on the E, that's just a standard gauge transformation. But omega is going to change in a bit of a non-trivial way. This is like the usual transformation. But here we get this extra term. And indeed, now we do get a dependence on the cosmological constant. And for the translation, we also have something similar. We still have a dependence on N here. And so, of course, it's also depending on the cosmological constant, but that was also the case in the original variables. We're going to see that these transformations actually are defining some kind of covariant derivative, new kind of covariant derivatives. We can look at the charges, right? We have symmetries. We can look at the charges that generate these symmetry transformations. And so we can look at the algebra they form. And if you look at the algebra they form, we get two actually central extensions. So this one is kind of, you see, it's between the rotation and the analog of the boost. And that's, so we had one already before. So that's kind of the usual central extension. But we also get this one here. That's an extra one. And this one is given by, we see that here, the dn comes up. So what we're going to demand now is that dn is zero. Because if dn is zero, then this means that this term is going to go away. Okay? So if dn is equal to zero, so we got... we have dn is equal to zero. And then now we can actually focus a bit on the shape of the vector. So the vector is parameterized as a norm that is parameterized by the cosmological constant. And so then we just have to find the direction. And since it's an arbitrary direction, because n is not the normal to the boundary or whatever, it's just an arbitrary vector, we're going to just take this n pointing in the third direction. But you remember that n could be different according to the sign of lambda. So we actually need to pick the metric so that things are consistent. So that's, I think, just a minor point, but I just wanted to emphasize that this is possible to do so. So we can take, for example, when in this case, there is no need to change a metric. In these cases, there is no need to change the metric, but in the other case, we're going to pick the metric such that it's consistent with the fact that we picked n to be in the third direction. Okay, so now we took dn to be zero, right?
Stupid question. I'm confused. Yes. What is d of dn?
Dn, that's just the derivative.
It's a vector or is a one form?
D is a vector.
N is a vector or a one?
N is a vector.
So what is D exactly?
So that's on the boundary, and so that's
what was? What is it? What is the D of a vector? Field, right? I mean, D acts on form. I'm just confused about the notation. This is a notation thing.
So I'm just picking up, I'm just demanding that this is constant. That's just what I'm asking. I just want n to be just kind of given by some constant. That's just what I'm going to have. That's only then if you do a gauge transformation that you might have some connection. But here I'm just saying basically my n is going to be specified by some constants. That's just what I want. And you see that my n here is picked such that it's gonna, the n the component, the third component, is just going to be specified by lambda, essentially. So n is just constant. That's just what I want to get.
But this is this fixed some coordinates on the boundary. What is what's the meaning?
So it's a constant vector. N is a constant vector. You know, it's given by 1, 2, 3. I mean, 0, 2, and lambda. Then, if you do a gauge transformation, then you can do a gauge transformation, and then you have the connection that's going to pop up. But the point is that I'm just picking n to be given by some constant in a choice. So I take n to be given by constant, and then I get. If you want to change coordinates, then now you're going to get a covariant derivative and so on. But so,
okay.
That it? That-
Okay, thanks, Florian.
Yeah, so my N3 is just going to be given by the cosmological constant. And so then we can look at the algebra. Yeah, we can look back at the algebra of charges that we had, and we see that now these charges basically they form a closed algebra because the extracentral extension is just gone. And then we can also look at, we can demand again. So here you see that there is a d alpha, and so I'm going to demand that these guys are going to be constant on the boundary. And so then that's going to go away. The central extension is going to be gone. The key point, which is different than what happened before, is that these charges, they form now a closed algebra, right? It's a D-algebra. Before, with the P's were the boost, and the boost were not closing into a D-algebra, but now these guys do form a D-algebra. And so this means that we're going to be able to discretize the theory. So we can look at the Lie algebra behind this structure. Here, before there was the Poisson algebra, now we can look at the Lie algebra. And so we have the rotational charges or Lorentz charges here, the Lorentz generators. And here the taus are the P prime, and they form what is called the AN2 Lie algebra. Okay, and so this AN2 Lie algebra is a structure constant parameterized by the N. So here I picked the guy like that, but obviously this can be defined in, for constant n. It has to be constant, right? That's what I want to impose. I can take an arbitrary n. So I do have also the cross terms. And in fact, when I put all this group bracket together, what I get is that these are the algebras that we got before, SO2-2 or SO3-1, SL2C. Which are decomposed according to what is called the Iwasawa decomposition. Before, what we did was the Cartan decomposition. Now we're doing the Iwasawa decomposition. Such Iwasawa decomposition does not exist for SO4, and SO4, which was the case Euclidean lambda positive. And indeed, we've seen that we had something n was complex, so we were kind of complexifying the algebra. So if we are complexifying the algebra, then we have to talk about reality condition and so on. We have to be more careful, and I'm not going to do that here. And so I'm not going to touch the case, the Euclidean case with lambda positive. It can be done, but one has just to be more careful. So we are decomposing our Lorentz SO2-2 or SL2C element in terms of an SU2 or SU11 or so in the Lorentz piece. And then this is the AN piece. This is like the new type of boost now. That's the algebra. So we have an action and a back action. And we have a killing form and so on. So to summarize now, what have we done? So basically what we did is that we perform a change of variables. This change of variable is parameterized by vector n, which has essentially, we can pick the vector n with one constant term here. And so the norm is parameterized by the cosmological constant. With this change of variable, we created a new connection. And the point is that before we had the frame field with value in the boost, but now it's with value in this AN Lie algebra. So that's going to be nice. The action is something like that. we have the equation of motion are transformed. And so this is actually a new notion of curvature, and this is going to be a new notion of torsion. Indeed, with this parametrization of SU2 and AN, we can see that the transformation that we had before are really given in terms of covariant derivatives. So we have a generalized covariant derivative in the SU2 case and the AN direction. Before, when we deal just with the boost, right, when we just deal with the boost, we don't have this this piece here, right? And so because there is just an action of the boost, there is just an action of the Lorentz transformation on the boost. There is no kickback action. And so here, this covariant derivative encodes the fact that there is always a kickback from one algebra to the other one. And these two covariant derivatives are actually dual to each other. So that's nice. And the symmetry transformation, symmetry transformation that of the new action here can be just simply characterized by this new notion of covariant derivative. We could remove these assumptions that I made before. So we can make N to be a field, like what Carl was kind of alluding to. But that would go beyond. So then we mean we have this central extension and so on. We could also demand that the N is going to be a full variable per se. So we allow some variation, but that's going beyond what I want to do now. Okay, so now let's go to the next piece of the preparation, which is basically the division for truncating. So the idea is that now what we want to do is that we want to evaluate the symplectic form to determine the discretized variables. What are the discrete variables of the theory? And so we have the symplectic form here, and so we did a canonical transformation. So that's now the piece of interest. And what we're going to do first is that we're going to divide. So this means that we're going to take our space manifold and we're going to cut this this manifold into cells, which I'm going to take triangles for simplicity. And so this means then that this integral here can be seen as a sum over the cells. So that's division. And then I truncate. And by truncating, it means that I'm going to demand that inside the cells, we do have the constraints, right? So the curvature, the generalized curvature has to be zero, and the generalized torsion has to be zero. If there is any curvature excitation or torsion excitation, I want to push them over the vertices of my triangulation, okay? But inside here, I'm going to demand that this is flat in this generalized sense and torsionless in this sense. If we want to do things properly, we should also put some regularization and so on. So we did that with Barak for the flat case, and I'm not going to do it here. That's going to bring more complicated things for nothing. I mean, that's it's not. I don't want to focus on that. So what we want to do is the truncation consists in imposing the constraints here, and so what I need to do then is to find the solutions of these guys. Okay, so I want to find a solution of that, of these guys in here, and then put them back in the symplectic form. Okay, so we need to find the solutions of this equation. So we need to find what is a flat connection in this generalized sense and a torsionless connection in this general, torsionless connection and frame field and so on. So to do so, we can, we're going to look at we'll see there's going to be some type of case transformation. And so for simplicity here, I'm going to focus on the Euclidean case with lambda negative. So this means that I'm dealing with a big structure that's SL2C or SO31. And I'm looking at that because in this case, the it was about the composition is actually global for this case. Otherwise, there are more complexities to deal with if it's not global, and we'll talk about that just at the very end. So I'm going to look at some holonomy that goes from a point in the cell, in the center of the cell, let's call it C, and it's going to go to an arbitrary point X. Okay, so this I'm taking this is here is going to be a SL2C element. But this SL2C element, I can break it up into AN piece, LC, and HC, SU2 piece. Okay, that's just the was about the composition that I've been talking about there. So I get some arbitrary holonomy there, and then I can find what are the solutions. In fact, the solutions are parameterized by that. So HC is this guy over there, right? So it's a SU2 holonomy that goes from C to X, and LC, some AN holonomy that goes from C to X as well. The point is that AN is not stable under the adjoint action of SU2. So this means that when you have an adjoint action of SU2 on AN, you get a piece that is in SU2, that's this one, and a piece that is in AN. Okay, and that's why we have two pieces here. So this might look complicated, but if you look at the lambda goes to zero case, then AN is kind of R3. And of course, here there is no such, now the SU2 act, there is no kickback of R3 on SU2. Okay, so this means that we just get one term here in R3, and this term is not there. And so then we recover just a normal definition of the flat connection. And here this is a discretized frame field, the usual definition of the frame field. So this is basically a generalization to the SL2 case. And this is accounting for the fact that there is some kickback, okay? AN kicks back on SU2. So now those are the solutions. So you can take these guys and put them in here and you're gonna get zero. So we want to put these solutions in the symplectic form that we had before, okay? So we just look at one cell, okay, which I call C star. I plug it in here. So then I get the formula. The formula is not really important. What I want to emphasize though is that this symplectic form can actually be just written in terms of a dependence just on the boundary. Okay, so that is it can be just rewritten as an integral on the boundary of the cell. Okay. And that's kind of very powerful. We're going to see that's very important. That's kind of a very nice result. So that was the preparation. Now we're ready to go. We want to go and try to get this treasure island. So let's start the journey. So we did get a symplectic form for each triangle that we have, each cell, right? We have one here, one here. But like I said, the symplectic form is defined in terms of the variables living on the boundary of the cell, okay? So then this means that the variables that we have in here, right? The X that we have here are just in here. But you see that this edge is shared by two cells. So I can actually look at the contribution of this cell and the contribution of this cell, but you see that basically since they share the same edge, maybe we can actually try to find, we can actually compose them together because they share the same edge, so they share the same guys. So one triangle is gonna have one frame, the other triangle is gonna have another frame. So this means that I should be able to relate the variables from each side, right, by doing a big transformation, a symmetry transformation. And here my variables were put together into some SL2C holonomy. And so here I do have my transformation that relate the two is basically this constant holonomy over there, right? So because everything is flat, I assume that things were flat, and if there is not flatness or flat and torsionless, right? If there is something here, you see that if I go, I can, this equation here just saying that this holonomy inside is flat. This constant holonomy can be split into AN piece and SU two piece. Okay, so this also can be viewed as some kind of continuity equation. Okay, so anyway, that's in the framework of edge mode and so on. But I didn't want to talk too much about that. So let's actually play a bit with this relation, this continuity equation. You see that this was true for any x over there. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to focus specifically on the x which is v here and the x which is v prime. So once again, here I'm going to say that inside these things are flat, right? So this means that I can compose, I can go from g, I can go from c to v, then v to c prime, there to there, and that's going to be the same. That's going to be the same thing. That's the constant autonomy over there. So we can do a bit of massaging by breaking these guys into AN piece and SU2 piece. And so when I do that, I massage a bit, and up, I get a new expression. This new expression is what? So I get L CV, right? So this L is going to go from here, from V to C to V prime. And since it's flat, this is kind of the same guy, the same as going there. Obviously, I get the same guy on the other side. I can go from B to C prime, to V prime. Okay, so that's the other guy. This is an AN autonomy. And then I have also SU2 piece, right? So the SU2 piece, I start from C, and go there, from there. But then I can also go on the other way, right? And they don't have to be the same, actually. So this means that on this CC prime, I get two kind of SU2 autonomy. This guy or the other guy. One guy is seen from V, the other guy is seen from V prime. And it's interesting that these guys, these autonomies, these triangular autonomies, actually appear and are part of the defining model of Kitaev. And these Kitaev calls them the triangular operators because it's working on the quantum level. And so this hints that we actually, the construction we're doing is actually very similar or the same as Kitaev's model. So we saw the geometric meaning of each of these autonomies, but the key point also is that you see that this there is a relation between all those four autonomies. And this relation can be seen as some kind of curvature equation, right? So it's closing. So we can have a ribbon here, right? I have four autonomies, so I'm going to have a ribbon. And this ribbon is essentially flat, right? That's what this condition is saying. So we're getting a ribbon structure. So why am I talking so much about that, so much about all these guys? So you remember that the goal was actually to define what is this quantity here. I get omega for this side and omega for the other side, and I know that the variables from one triangle to the other one are actually related by some constant transformation over there. In fact, if you do calculate, and that's a non-trivial thing to do, if you do calculate this symplectic form here, you get a new symplectic form that depends exactly on the variables that I just introduced before. Okay, so that's right. So you get an expression that depends only on those variables, and you have this ribbon structure. And I want to emphasize that this is still, you can show that this is still a symplectic form. So this means that I'm defining a phase space. And this is a phase space of the discretized variables. So these autonomies that I've defined are the discretized variables that, that I was looking for. And obviously, this is not a cotangent space. This is something more general because now I get elements in SU2, element in AN. So cotangent space usually is just a manifold with a cotangent plane, right? It's a plane. And here, the momentum is curved. So we have a generalization of the usual cotangent plane. And in fact, when we get to that, you might not know it, but you, here we go. We reached the treasure island. We got the quantum group structure. In fact, here what we did is maybe the first step to go easy and before getting to the quantum group structure What we found here is a model that we introduced back in the days with Valentin, Maite, and Etera, and also I think it was so discreet and analyzed a bit by Laurent and Rosé Antonio. So we have recovered the ribbon model, some ribbon model. So I will talk a bit about the ribbon model, but so let's talk before what we can invert the symplectic form and get Poisson brackets. And so the Poisson brackets, I'm not going to go too much in the formula, it's not very important. So here I just focus on the what are the fluxes, and here are the SU2 anomalies. So if you consider the case where lambda is zero, right? So you can just consider the R3 case. It's not AN, it's R3. Then in this case, the H tilde, right, here is actually H, and the L is, so L is going to be like the flux, and X tilde is basically the parallel transport of the flux through H, right? So here we have X associated with this this point here, and what we can do is that we can parallel transport this guy on this side over there with H. And this abstract nonsense formula is just reproducing the fact that the X's form the SU2 Lie algebra as a Poisson algebra. And the H's here, they do form something that is zero. Now, if you look at the case where we deal with the AN, then in this case, you can look at what is the structure, the Poisson structure for the matrix element of these holonomies, and you see that the matrix element of these holonomies do not Poisson commute for most of them. So this means that upon quantization, the holonomies, the matrix element of the holonomies are not going to commute, so that's how we're going to get the quantum group structure. So what about the ribbon model? So the idea is that usually in the LQG, we talk about the spin network. This is a dual of the triangulation here. And what we're doing is that we're replacing this dual graph by ribbons. And the ribbons somehow have the full information about the variables, the discrete variables, right? We have the L tilde, or the X, the flux, the parallel transported flux, and the H. And in the curve case, we also have H tilde. And so just like L tilde or X tilde is a parallel transport of X by H, you can see H tilde as a parallel transport of H by L. So there is a kickback. Essentially, that's a kickback action. The flux is also transporting the holonomy in a way. So we have these ribbons, and now we can put together these ribbons, right? Before we just talked about the graph and we had the edges, we just have the dual graph. So now we're talking about ribbons. And you see that here the ribbons are glued together, and the S basically they form, there is some kind of holonomy, a closed holonomy here formed by the S, and that's a product of the L. And if you go to the flat case, you see that this is just encoding that the sum of the x's is equal to zero. So this is like the analog of the Gauss constraint. And you can check that this L's, they still generate the infinitesimal rotation or Lorentz transformation. So we can do the same for the flatness constraint. So now we have, so the dual graph, it goes around the vertex. So if there could be some curvature over there. And so now we're replacing the structure by ribbons. And now we see that we have actually here SU2 holonomies that go around. So I'm going to erase the kind of the structure of the ribbons up. We're just going to keep this piece. And you see that this piece now, if we demand flatness, so no curvature there, we're just going to demand that this piece is equal to 1. And like I said, so if you are in the regular lambda is equal to 0 case, these HT are just normal H's. So we just recover the normal model. And once again, you can also check that this flatness constraint also generates infinitesimal translation. And so we're supposed to talk about quantum groups. So here we're just going to do, in fact, once we have the phase space, the Heisenberg double, it's basically kind of textbook construction. So we use this quantization with Valentin Maite to actually try to quantize this ribbon model. And so the Poisson bracket was characterized by this little R matrix. So kappa is a function of the cosmological constant Ng. And so we're going to quantize this little R, and we're going to get what is called a quantum R matrix. The L element, we can use a representation. So yeah, we can use a 2x2 representation. And so the matrix elements are going to become operators now. And so I'm going to just call them J plus, K, and so on. And then we can quantize this Poisson structure, the Poisson bracket, into this this type of relation. You can check that if you go in the classical limit, this basically is an approximation of that. And then if you plug in these guys and you play with that, you just recover the defining relations of UQ SU2. Okay. Now, this is not enough, obviously. What we want is something more. We want we want to see how we get gauge invariance, right? So initially, you remember that we had the group elements that were doing a product, and this product we demanded that to be one, right? That was to ensure that we have some gauge invariance at this node over there. And so now, since we have three elements, three S that depend in three different phase spaces, we're going to use a tensor product, and we're going to get three different operators. The L's have become L hat, right? Those are my L hat. And this is just, again, the product. But if you look at what's happening in terms of the components, this condition here is just basically the same as asking that the co-product of UQ SU2 is basically equal to zero or one. Yeah. So here it's a one on the three. It's a big one, obviously a big identity. So we recover the co-product of UQ SU2 from the product of the L's. And so therefore, that's how we get that. Now, if we look at the vector that solves this this condition, we're going to get a quantum group intertwiner. So that's how we're getting actually the quantum group structure. So to summarize, I emphasized at the beginning, in the usual formulation of 3D gravity, we don't have a cosmological constant dependence for the gauge transformation. So we performed a canonical transformation. We added a Bonnari term. And then what we did is that we divided and truncated. So we evaluated, we looked at the solution of the constraints in the cells. Okay, so that was kind of the discretization recipe. I didn't treat the clean case because it needs to be more carefully done, because there are many subtleties with this eye that pops up. You have to, reality conditions are difficult. I mean, yeah, more difficult. We have seen that there is room actually to go beyond the quantum group case, because we can remove some conditions on the N. So that's kind of interesting, and it will be interesting to explore what are the implications. We can have a different N, okay? So we could try to have different N, so pick different vectors pointing in different directions. And then what are the relations in terms of the quantum group? I think that's some question, mathematical question that has not really been explored. And I think that's an interesting one. We could also try to define different spin networks with different N domain walls. I mean, I know Itera was thinking about that at some point. Not domain walls, but different values of the cosmological constant and things like that. Here, I always focused on putting on the standard picture, more standard picture, which is to put the fluxes in terms of the edges and the SU2 anomalies on the links. But of course, we can actually swap that. We can put the SU2 anomalies on the edges and the fluxes on the links. And I think that's more related to the BF picture. And here we get the deformed picture. The deformed BF picture. BF vacuum picture introduced by Bianca and Mark. And like I was saying also at some point, sometimes when the decomposition is not unique. I mean, if you are connected to the identity, you have a nice it was about decomposition, but if you're not connected to identity, then you can have extra decoration. And so you can have it was about decomposition, can have extra group elements that decorate this it was about decomposition, which means in a way that the ribbon might be decorated. So then it means that it's not really flat. We have this flatness is just decorated by extra pieces. So that's something interesting to explore. We didn't do that yet. Let me make some more general comments. So here, the truncation basically is imposing that we decompose our space into uniform blocks. And so we have this generalized curvature, which was flat. Okay, we have flat curvature, but this is actually encoding homogeneously, I mean, from the A piece, from the A connection, that's kind of encoding some homogeneous curvature. And so this is kind of related to the geometric structures that Carlip talks about in his book. I think the construction illustrates nicely how we can put some boundary term and so on, a topological term, and such that the theory becomes nicer. So in the initial formulation of the theory, we basically it was difficult to discretize. We didn't know what to do. We added a boundary term. We did a canonical map, and then up we could actually find the discretization of the theory. And also another effect was that we actually changed the symmetry, the nature of the symmetries. Initially, we didn't have a dependence on lambda, and then we had one. So I think that's kind of really in the spirit of the LQG picture, for example, with the MRZ parameter and so on. I mean, and that's kind of going to the program of Laurent and Daniele and so on, and Mark and so on. Since the N that we introduced can be seen indeed as some kind of MRZ parameter, except that here the vector N is actually parametrized by the cosmological constant. So we're actually not introducing a new parameter because it's actually the cosmological constant here. And so it would be interesting to see if, you know, if this quantization is really different than a quantization that if we are not introducing this N, so I suspect we are not using quantum groups. So that would be a different discretization or something totally different. We also recovered, in fact, the analog of the Kitaev model. So here I didn't assume that we have particle excitation, so curvature excitation or torsion excitations, but we could put those as suspect, and things we would get we would really get exactly the same structure as what Kitaev is using. And so what I find interesting is that this Kitaev model, it's like a BF model for usually is using finite groups. So it's a BF model for finite groups. They are trying to do that in the labs. So I find interesting to try to explore then the connection. So if they are doing, so in a way they are going to do 3D gravity models or analogs to 3D gravity models in a lab. So it would be interesting to see if we can find questions inherent to 3D gravity or quantum gravity and try to explore them in this context. I think that 3D gravity has been very much underappreciated. And if this is a context where we do have a theory, a good quantum gravity theory, and so we should try maybe to answer more questions about the physics of quantum gravity, even though obviously it's different than 4D. And so we could hope that all what I talked about is actually relevant to improve also our understanding to what happens in 4D. And I just want to sketch very quickly some ideas. Indeed, I think it could be relevant. So I've been starting to look at that with Abdelmajid. So you can start with the usual action and then add a boundary term. So the boundary term is going to be very similar to the one I added before, just adapted to the 4D case. Adding this boundary term is going to generate, it's basically a canonical transformation. Okay, and the canonical transformation is very similar to the one that introduced before in the 3D case. So then we can try to re-express the theory in terms of the new connection. And now again, if we assume some normalization condition on the vector n, then we're going to cancel the volume term that we have here. And then we can try to rewrite the action. Also maybe, yeah, I would just wanted to comment also on the different cases. So if we have n is normalized, we basically get a bunch of different conditions according to the signature. And so for example, in the Euclidean case, lambda positive, we're going to get imaginary. So that's going to be probably root of unity again. When lambda is negative, no, so that's going to be probably space-like, so there's going to be probably some real deformation. And in the Lorentzian case, so when lambda is positive, so that's going to be the physical case, and it's going to be time-like in this case. So this is kind of giving a hint of what kind of deformation we're going to get, right? Of course, this has to be done. And so we have to actually do the Hamiltonian analysis and see whether we get a deformed Gauss constraint. I think preliminary calculations seem to indicate yes, but we still have to be sure of that. Then we have to discretize, right? We have to divide to truncate. And then is it, I don't know yet, if it means that we're going to have to deal with a flux, which is some kind of AN2 holonomy. So I don't know, that's an open question. Maybe something interesting also to explore is, since we just deform, you just added a boundary term here, we could consider what Daniele was presenting the other day and see how this addition of an extra boundary term is kind of modifying the structure. So the big deal they had was that they had the sitter Poincaré spin network, so now maybe they get the sitter in the lambda positive case. I don't know. All right, thank you. That's it.
Okay, so let's thank Florian.
Let me try to see if I can see faces.
Yeah. Okay, so now—
Hello, everyone.
Yeah. We can unmute everyone. Yes, okay. So let's first see if students and postdocs have questions, and then we move to everyone. So I think that now you should be able to unmute yourself, so you don't need to raise your hand if you want to ask a question. You can just unmute yourself and ask the question.
Go, Carlo. No. I think you need to unmute yourself.
They cannot? Okay, then, okay, let's...
Oh, yeah, that's it. I think you can speak.
Now, yes. Yes. Daniele, you control us, so you...
Yeah, I think Josh was supposed to release the power I have at the end of the...
Well, maybe there's some delay because I tried. Maybe there's some delay because it becomes...
Options are not good. I'll just double check.
All right. So, first of all, it's very nice, very, very, very nice, very clean, very, very beautiful presentation from you. Thanks a lot. I really learned a lot. I find of in your this question is about the perspective and of what you mentioned at the end. I found extremely interesting what you were saying about 4D and the possibility that this actually tell us something about 4D, which is where of course we want to go. Now in 3D, what you have done is you've mostly talked about sort of the kinematics, not about the dynamics. But as I said at the beginning, there is a dynamics which we know well. You, as you were saying, you discussed the path, but the arrival point, it's sort of the island is we know where it is, which is dry zero essentially. So we know the transition amplitude. We know what happens when you add one dimension, no? And that's the perspective. Now in 4D, there are a couple of beautiful constructions with the full dynamics. One is the sort of Fairbairn-Mossberger construction, and the other is the one by Han, Mushin, which do give a dynamics. They have not been studied much because it's complicated to work with. I mean, it's hard to work with these quantum groups when you actually want them to compute something. But they're there, both of them, and I don't have clear how they work. In fact, I don't even know the extent to which they resemble one another, if they do and how much. But you seem to have tools for trying to arrive. Do you have some understanding of the relation between this way of thinking and there? Because there seem to be some strong similarities, some these analogies as well. Could you connect to what they were doing, or could you use them to modify what they were doing, whatever?
Okay, so first, what I would do here, what I would do is basically first work at the kinematical level. That's as you noticed. So first, I want to derive the fact that spin networks have to be deformed. So in the 4D case, usually, so we put the quantum group structure by hand. In 3D, there's Chang-Simon, Tuai-Viro. I mean, there's a lot of arguments. In 4D, that's maybe less clear. There is one argument that says, oh, maybe if you start with BF plus BB, then this BF plus BB is basically related to Chang-Simon on the boundary. And then since you have a Chang-Simon on the boundary, then you might have on the boundary states, I might have some curvature, and that's what Hall and Aldo and so on, I think, explored a lot. But then in their construction, the lambda, the Chan-Simon theory, had a cosmological constant that was not really related to the cosmological constant of the 4D picture. And so there are the different cases, there are the two choices. So here, I think, in the approach that I'm talking about here, things are maybe more... so I'm just following a route. And so I think in this case, it seems to me I would get a specific deformation. So that's to talk about the kinematics. And then you need to talk about the dynamics. And so for the dynamics in the 3D case, we could define the dynamics in terms of, so that's what we did with Valentin. And the idea was that we generalize something that Valentin and Laurent did. And so basically that was to try to recover some recursion relation for the 6J symbol by looking at we started from a scalar product and demanded that the scalar product is parallel transport. Anyway, those are technical things. So we could generalize that in the deform case. In the 4D case, so usually the models are built by hand. I mean, there are some tools, different recipes. And so at this stage, I'm not totally sure if I can bring something new. At this stage, what I'm focusing now is how to derive the kinematical structure. So how do we get the quantum group structure at the kinematical level? Then the dynamics, that's always a big question in the spin form formalism. I think that then you have to come up with your own arguments for that. Maybe there's going to be some argument from the boundary picture, I don't know. But at this stage, for the specific model, I don't know, am I going to get a PRL or Barrett-Cren? I mean, that's up to you, right? At this stage, I'm not really too sure.
No, but the way you presented it is that there is a dry zero, which is a full theory.
Yeah.
And you said it's sort of, I mean, that's the way theoretical physics work, right? You start rough and then you understand better. So, and then you say, look, you said I've long been trying to understand how one gets clearly there. I mean, Alejandro tried and with Karim and here you give a very nice, now what I'm saying is that there are some fully four-dimensional, you don't have to reinvent them. There are some them in the literature, full transition amplitudes for quantum gravity with a cosmological constant with a quantum group in the literature. And so the obvious question is that, does it looks like the kinematic that they have might match with the one can get with this path, or necessarily different?
So, like I think I remember you told me some time ago. If I look at the 4D case, you know, I should it was a root of unity. I should look at root of unity. Right, but that's why I mean.
That's because the natural there's a natural advantage with quantum groups within Tura-Vira. One sees very nicely, and one doesn't have some kind of divergences that one have in Ponsano-Regge. And so there's an old idea that this indeed the cosmological constant acts as a regularization.
Fair enough. Yeah. But so here from, fair enough. But so here from this approach, I would say maybe what's actually more natural is to consider the real case. I mean, here it's a choice. So then the question is, you see, we're going to get different descriptions. So I can use a real vector or an imaginary vector. So I'm going to get, some cutoff, I guess. I'm going to get a cutoff on the representation or not in this case. And so, but a priori, I could do either of the two. So
well, nature has chosen one value of lambda, doesn't do both.
No. But that's, of course, here it's always with lambda positive. It's just that the nature of the end, that's the nature of the deformation.
Okay. So if nature has a theory, has chosen one. So,
it means that, I don't know. So, that's what one of my points was that this quantum group construction that I provided is like this immersive parameter thing where we're adding a parameter. It happens that here the parameter is a cosmological constant. It's not like an extra parameter in the game. But so when you add an extra parameter, the question is, in terms of a boundary term, is a theory depending on this, is the physics depending on this boundary term or not? Like, we have the there's these theta Young meets. So you're adding a term. Is the theory depending on this theta or not? And so here you see that here I can have different n. So here it's one n is real, the other n is root of unity. So what are the? I mean, as a consequence, I'm going to get. It looks like I'm going to get some important differences, right? One is I'm going to get a cutoff, and the other one I'm not. So the point is that here I'm adding a boundary term and I'm getting different theories according to the nature of the boundary term I'm getting. And so is it physically relevant or not? I think that's kind of part of the same question that for this theta Young Mills. I can add a theta to Young Mills and then is the theory depending on that or not? I mean, is it physical or not? I don't know.
Okay, so I see there are several people want to ask questions, so let's go with the next one. I think Aldo is...
Hi, yes. Hi, Flo.
Hey.
I wanted to... So just a quick clarification. You say that N is this boundary... you add it at the... You use it to modify your boundary symplectic structure. But in fact, when you do this change of variables from A to omega, you need N everywhere, right? Also in the bulk.
So N is a constant vector, so I just N, yeah?
Yeah, and no, okay. So then you extend it into, is not, you need it also in the bulk, that's... Or am I misunderstanding something? It's not necessarily a deep question. I don't think
I can have it in the back, but you know, n is just a constant vector that is just a cosmological constant in a way, so it's just a number.
Okay, right? But then my second question about that is, why do you have an understanding why it comes out that n should be constant and not covariantly constant? Because it has this SU2 index, so it would be more natural maybe that it would be covariantly constant with respect to your initial connection A or something like that.
I don't know, Laurent, you want to comment on that? I unmuted you.
The main difference is really the structure of the boundary algebra, right? So the boundary algebra, so the choice of n affects the choice of the boundary symmetry algebra. And when n is a constant, you know, not covariantly, n is a, if you think about it, n is a scalar. So
yeah.
What Florian maybe did not say, but he didn't emphasize, is that delta of n is equal to zero. So n is a gauge invariant scalar. So when you look at the gauge transformation of n, it doesn't get rotated by gauge transformation. Okay, so this is one of the elements of the symmetry transformation.
But that's what is strange. Like just by looking at it without fully understanding the formalism, you have this n, which is a space-time scalar valued in internal.
These
vectors do not rotate.
Yeah, no, this is strange, and this is the subtle point. That is, if I was putting an n there, which rotates when I make a gauge transformation, then what I would do by introducing this n, I would just break the symmetry. What Florian did, but you know, I think he could have emphasized it more, is that here you're introducing a vector, and what you're doing is that you're changing the symmetry transformation, so you're deforming the symmetry such that this vector stays invariant under gauge transformation. So it's a very important and radically new idea. The new idea is that I'm not just breaking the symmetry, that would be silly. I would destroy what I have on the boundary. So it is important that n doesn't transform under gauge transformation. And that's the reason why there is still deformation of symmetry versus a breaking.
Yeah.
And I would need two or three slides to really explain that clearly, but that's really the central idea behind the emergence of quantum group symmetry. The fact that it's possible to do so, that's really the point that took us a while to understand. So I understand your question. You're thinking that n is a symmetry breaking parameter, but it is not.
It's not. Yeah, if you look at the symmetries, that just. Okay.
So yeah, maybe do you have in your slide somewhere the transformation of n, that delta alpha of n is zero.
Yeah.
It doesn't transform under gauge transformation.
Yeah.
Right. If you look at the gauge transformation, you see that delta alpha of n is equal to zero. So it's quite remarkable that you can have a gauge transformation that doesn't rotate n and still is active.
I think Mark wants to comment something.
I hope that helps.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thanks.
Where is Mark?
Mark, are you ready?
Thanks, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Flo, for the nice talk. Yeah, I have actually a follow-up question to Aldo's question. It's maybe related, because I was also a bit confused in the beginning, because I understood that at some point you did two things. You started by introducing a boundary term.
Yeah.
And then you also did a change of variable in the bulk, right?
Yeah.
So then presumably, once you change the bulk, I mean, this new bulk theory has its own symplectic structure, which has changed because you changed it in the bulk. So I'm wondering how it fits together that you change something on the boundary and in the bulk if these two things don't kind of undo each other, and which, I mean, because it seems to me you would either do one thing or the other, but if you do both at once, then I'm confused. But, and maybe related, actually maybe the solution, but which was also confusing to me, is that in principle, if you add a boundary term to Lagrangian, as you know, you don't change the symplectic structure. You change the potential, but not the symplectic structure. So then I did not understood how you get all these new boundary symmetries if you don't change the symplectic structure. Unless you're actually working with the potential that you get by shifting the bulk.
Yes. Wait. Well, I think Maite is on mute. I have to unmute her. Unmute her.
Sorry. Sorry, guys. Hey, everyone.
It's my laptop. Sorry. So, so what can I say? So you worry that so I can perform a change of a canonical map. So that's basically this transformation here is a canonical map. And you worry that this is an issue for, I mean, if you look at the symplectic form is indeed the same, right? So if when you calculate it, and I wrote it at some point, it's expressed in terms of the A and the omega, so they are exactly the same. So I don't think that I have an issue there. Sorry.
Laurent wants to weigh in, maybe, or no? I think you can unmute yourself. Can't you unmute yourself?
Yes, now we can again. Yeah, thanks, Flo, for, I mean, yeah. I can maybe ask you later, because maybe it's more.
I think so. We took n as a constant vector. I mean, all what I presented, I wanted to avoid the Chern-Simon picture. But obviously, you can do everything I've done in the Chern-Simon picture. And actually, that at the beginning, I used that. I was kind of cheating here. You can use a Chern-Simon picture. And what you do is that you can start from with a big connection, which is with value in SL2C. And this big connection, usually you split it into the Cartan piece, right? SU2 and boost. And the frame field is in the boost. But what you can do is that instead you do this, you do the inverse over decomposition. And then in this case, you get the frame field with value in the tau. And you can check that this is a canonical transformation. And the inverse over decomposition is parametrized by this vector n. Okay, so and then so it's a canonical map from this perspective, and the n, I think, leaves it's a constant n, so I guess you can bring it in the bulk.
I'm staring at the N3 equation again above the red box, and now I understand my question. Now I see.
I think the idea there is, if I can add something to your answer. The idea that you can either write the theory as a usual bulk term plus a boundary term, or you can reabsorb this boundary term by a redefinition of the bulk connection, and now you don't have any boundary term.
Yeah,
things are equivalent. So on one hand, the addition of a boundary term can be viewed as a deformation of the symmetry algebra, but you can also, by reabsorbing it, view it as a deformation of the bulk gauge algebra. These are these two point of view. As you know, you can.
But I think, in fact, what you're doing is actually very similar to this thing which people have done in 3D, that you can shift, actually, just like you do, the connection by an E piece. And then you get a new theory in which you can trade the curvature, which is in the field strength, and to put it in the torsion. And then you also change the boundary symmetries and you change the central extensions. And except that here, instead of shifting just by E, you shift by a gauge transformation of E because it's E wedge N.
Yeah.
Okay, Hal has a question, I think.
Thanks. Thanks, Florian. The talk was fantastic. I'm really excited about this way of looking at things, although I wish I understood. I have questions along the same lines as Mark and Aldo's, which I was going to try and ask it in a geometrical way. So if we pick out this vector n, you said this leads to this nice new notion of curvature and a new notion of torsion. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you understand what those two new notions of curvature and torsion are geometrically, because that would really help me to understand what this N is doing in terms of the physics of the geometry of the space-time.
So what kind of geometrical interpretation you would wish? I mean, so usually when you work with, so usually you have curvature and torsion is actually with value in the translations or on the boost. And so you just have one action. So you get a derivative. The torsion is actually a covariant derivative on the R3 sector, but because there is an action of SU2, on the translations, then you get this you get the covariant derivative, you get the SU2 connection that acts on the frame field. Right? That's you could see it because you know there is an action of the rotation on the translations. Right? This rotation curvature and torsion are in fact a big curvature, right? That's a curvature into for example, the Poincaré algebra.
Yes.
And then you look at the components, and then up you see that there could be a difference between the two, and there could be a difference because so if you just consider the translation, there's just an action of SU2 on the translation. Translation don't kick back. Okay. And so the derivative. I mean, you get the formula for the torsion because there is just an action of SU2 on the translation or on the boost. Otherwise, why should you get this torsion formula? I mean, it should just be because if you're looking at the translation piece, it's an abelian structure, so you shouldn't have SU2 bumping on the translation. You see what I mean? So I'm talking about algebra here, right? It's not as geometric as you wish. And what I'm doing here is decomposing SL2C into SU2 and AN, and now there is a kickback. So SU2 acts on AN and AN kicks back. So this means that now I have a symmetric definition of covariant derivative or curvature in a way. They are both torsion and curvature in SL2C, and they are more symmetric. And then I have covariant derivatives in the SU2 slice, or covariant derivative in the AN slice, which have actions. Then what can I say more about the geometry? I don't know. What can I say?
I can build on the question just a little bit. I don't want to take up too much time, but Aldo and I have been discussing for years a very simple question. If we're just looking at SU2Q, and in SU2Q, it seems, you know, you start out with the SU2 algebra where the three generators are treated on a very democratic footing. But then in SU2Q, JZ is suddenly treated on a very different footing than the other two generators. And we were always puzzled by this. It's still a symmetry algebra. So what's picking out JZ as special? What's going on here? And it seems to me like you're picking that point out very nicely through your whole construction, that somehow you're picking out a direction and that direction matters. And it should be shedding light on this question that we've been asking each other for years.
Yeah.
But I don't get it yet.
Well, I think the AN sector with this AN covariant derivative and so on. So like Laurent was saying, we have this deformed symmetry. So even though we have a preferred direction, the AN, I mean the N, then we still have symmetries and everything behaves nicely. And so we can pick the N. So I had a discussion about that this morning with Laurent. And so we can say, oh, the, let's take N pointing in the third direction. And that's just like a definition. We're going to define the third direction like that. But a priori, you could have you could take an N, I could take my N, and then that would be related by a rotation. And then our two constructions should be related by a unitary transform or rotation. This is, I think, is not something that has been explored by, nothing has been explored by mathematicians. I think that's an open question. But the point is that we need to put this N in the game. And the point is that N does not transform, like Laurent recalled. N does not transform, but still we have nice gauge transformations. Everything is covariant, even though N does not transform. And N encodes a preferred direction. That's the key point of quantum groups, right? We have a preferred direction, but the symmetries are deformed, they are not broken.
So, I mean, everything you just said is very clear and makes sense to me, but I don't understand it physically yet. Lambda, we don't... Up to now, I've never thought of lambda as a vector. Lambda is a scalar. It tells me about a rate. It doesn't, or a length scale. It doesn't tell me a direction. So
it does not, right? I mean, here in the construction, I just lambda is just one value of the components. I'm taking all the components zero, right? So the direction here, I don't, in a way, it's not really important, right? What's really, what matters really is the value of the parameter, which is lambda.
May I jump in I've always had the same confusion as Hal about what groups, exactly the same confusion. I do buy everything which is said, that the symmetry is not violated, this deformed, there's still a symmetry, still Q symmetry and everything. Still, there is one special direction, which is Z. And how do I, what does it mean physically here? I mean, can I pinpoint where is this direction? Maybe in one particular solution, in one sense. And I want to follow up what Hal is saying. Maybe what you're doing now can help us exactly to understand that. Because if it is true that we can, in the context of quantum gravity, understand the cosmological constant by using quantum groups, which we all hope is true, then your construction seems to be addressing exactly this question by saying, look, there's a vector N that is playing a role and we can understand it better. Now, in fact, what you said before is, well, when we were discussing, you said, well, it's this boundary thing is like the theta QCD. Does it have a meaning? We don't know. We know that theta QCD has a meaning. Of course we know. Because if it had different values, CP would be violated in the strong interaction and it's not. So it's a parameter that in the context of the theory had it is as a completely clear phenomenological dependence. So it's not that this new parameters that enters the quantum theory and are not in the classical theory have no physical consequences.
Well, the thing that Freud was unsettled, yeah.
So is there in principle some quantum effect that is picked up by N? And does this mean that if I'm here, the presence of the cosmological constant give me a direction in some sense?
So the cosmological constant appears as a norm of the vector, right?
No, but it's the related quantum physics. Does it chooses a direction? And if not, it's just somehow in the actual physics, in the transition amplitudes, do I see this direction disappearing? How does it work?
Well, so we actually talked about that this morning with Laurent. So from what I gathered, I think that the idea is that if you have your N, I have my N, we are pointing in different directions, there is a rotation that relates the two, and I expect that what you're going to measure using your N and me using my N should be related by some kind of unitary relation or rotation. There should be a map. I think that that's kind of the idea. Laurent, that's what we agree.
Yeah, I think these are very interesting questions. I think at some point, this N parameterized different canonical parametrization. I think the norm of N, which is lambda, so in some sense, Al, I agree that it's saying that lambda, we should think of it as a vector. In fact, that's true, not a scalar. And now the norm of that vector does parameterize like theta vacua in equivalent vacua. Okay, because it drastically changed the value of the boundary algebra. Now the direction of that vector, it's a little bit like the direction Sx versus, you know, versus Sy. It parametrizes a preferred a choice of basis. So two quantum groups associated with different ends are in fact unitarily equivalent, and they nobody has really, you know, written down explicitly that rotation map, but a priori, you see it's possible because it just corresponds to a canonical transformation. And in fact, maybe these techniques would allow you to do that. So to really understand what it means for a quantum group to change the axis of rotation, right? Like change of basis from XX to XY, right? Maybe an analogy is a bit like a regularization. To define a quantum theory, you need to introduce a cutoff, right? Even if the theory does not depend, you know, and then the proper definition of the theory means that you can remove that cutoff. So the theory doesn't depend on that cutoff, but you need to introduce a cutoff to define the theory. I think here it's the same. You need to introduce this direction to define the discretization of the quantization, even if, you know, the direction of that vector just amounts to a change of basis. I
find that logic, I mean, I agree with much of what you're saying, but I find it a bit surprising, right? If we take symmetries as being a deep part of physics, and we all do, I think, then it seems like a surprise that this would be an auxiliary thing that wasn't profoundly...
Well, maybe, in fact, in the continuum, I don't know if this is an equivalent or equivalent quantization, right? So, maybe the jury is still open, maybe... The direction of N is like theta, therefore a physical observable. And then, you know, I think we don't know. Now maybe we can ask that question.
But, so to add to this, in
just one second, because I think we only have like 8 minutes left at most. So I think Bianca wanted to ask a question.
Yeah.
So if she wants, Bianca, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So before we had this lengthy discussion on the N, my question would be about 4D. Flo, you had this table with the possibilities of Lorentzian and Euclidean.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm happy to see that it seems in the Lorentzian case, we can also expect a quantum deformation at the root of unity.
I guess, yeah.
Do you have an idea, because whether we are at the root of unity or not, it's related to having compact or non-compact symmetries. So I guess I have two questions. Are these symmetries more like NBF or actually for NBF meaning the B translation symmetry, or is it more like diffuse? And do you have an idea what these two different cases correspond to in terms of a possible translation symmetry?
So that's far, far ahead.
Okay. So because ADS, I mean, we usually think of it as non-compact, and so it seems nevertheless somehow if you do something. Imagine.
Yeah, but it could be related to the fact that when you have a quantum group, you have a Q deformation, you can play with this deformation being, imaginary, I mean, a root of unity or Q complex or Q real, right? It seems that in the Lorentzian case, we have more room in a way, right? Because...
So you haven't talked about somehow the geometry, because in 3D, it's really, we have homogeneously curved building blocks and they are compact and so on.
But this kind, actually, I didn't write them, but in the Lorentzian case, this is actually exactly the same table. So I think the change of map here, the change of the canonical map and so on works, I think, probably in any dimension, because it works very similarly in in 3D and 4D. And I think that's just contracting epsilons, Levi-Civita tensors. Mm-hmm. And I think that, so in the Lorentzian case, because it's Lorentzian, there is more room. Right, you mm-hmm. can have space-like or time-like if you allow for complex stuff. Whereas in the Euclidean case, well, you know, there is no time-like or space-like. There is only space-like, right? So in the Lorentzian case, it seems to me that it's more natural to have more deformation. But the point is that we didn't do the analysis. I'm not even sure if the kinematics here is going to be how it's going to happen, right? For example, if we see that in the physical case, n is time-like. So I don't know how if that is going to bump into the fact that we have the time gauge, right? Is there like a clash between that? And if we ask N to be time-like, I'm not totally sure. We didn't really explain.
Well, and so far it didn't have any meaning. But if I guess, I would guess that there's kind of two different kinds of building blocks, maybe with different kind of geodesics.
Oh, yes. Yeah, possibly. I don't know.
As boundary things, you know. So and one kind of building block is always compact, and some or the geodesics are bounded, and then the other one not. So maybe that's somehow related to that effect.
It could be, but I don't know. That's too far ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So we have just a couple of minutes left. If there is some quick comment.
Aldo wanted something.
Oh, well, I can try to say it quickly. What we studied with Hall when we were looking into these quasi Hamiltonian system and quasi Poisson systems was a slightly different approach to the symmetries, where instead of deforming the symmetry, one was deforming what one meant by symplectic structure. And at that point, one could have symmetries as like the boost basis was good enough in a sense. So that allowed to have generators associated to these boosts. And so in that case, it seems that the symmetry is preserved. There is no N that one doesn't need to introduce an N. So it seems like, I don't know if the two approaches are equivalent. I think that classically they are, because I remember a theorem stating that, but it might be that this doesn't hold upon quantization. So the idea is that there might be a classically equivalent approach where is the symplectic structures that is the form. One can associate generators to boosts, even if they don't form a Lie algebra. And the difficulty is that, of course, one doesn't have really a symplectic space, but one is preserving explicitly the rotation symmetries. So it's just to add a layer of confusion maybe to this set of questions.
No, but I think that's kind of you would go by quantizing. You would like to focus just on this piece, and then I'm going to add a piece. And I think that's where I always come back to that, but that's like you can have Young-Mills and then Young-Mills plus theta. And then so we know, or we have some good ideas to check whether it's physical or not. And here, I think it's unclear whether doing your thing is going to be equivalent to doing the usual quantum picture. This is difficult, I think, in Young-Mills. So I think in our case, it's going to be very tricky. That would be my take.
All right. So
thank you.
Last comment before we...
I think it would be interesting to understand the interplay between spinform models and the boundary algebra. That is really true, and it would be nice to do that. I wanted to say something more about this N. So I say and that it's just a canonical transformation, and Hall was resisting. And in some sense, he's right, because what it means is that once you have a preferred basis, you also have a notion of preferred notion of vacua, right? So this is really what N is about, if you think about it. N is about what do we call the vacua structure of the theory. And you could say, well, the vacua is very simple. It's F equals zero and torsion equals zero. But remember that these two things do not commute. So at the quantum level, there is in fact in equivalent ways to impose the quantum equations of motion, right? And in some sense, I think this is what N is. Ultimately, there is a big canonical structure, but different quantum groups point towards what is the preferred vacua there. And if that's the case, it'd be like the theta vacua, you know? So if that's the case, yeah, it should be an extra observable. As we learned from the work of Bianca, that there's the, you know, E vacua, the F vacua, but there's all these in-between vacua. So that's a way to think about it. The last comment was about, he was asking the physicality of this N, and it has to do with translation. If you think about it, when you have cosmological constant, the translation do not commute. So N allow you to kick back a rotation so that you create translation that are consistent in some sense. But I think these two things together, it doesn't mean we understand the physics of that, because this is what we want to understand in 4D, but I think these are very, very good questions.
All right, so let's thank Florian again.
Thank you all.
Thank you.